I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity, so we saved you some time to get right to the good stuff. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Happy New Year. In a little while, we're going to explore what the atmosphere around drinking looks like in Vermont today, where healthy living is a part of the culture, but so is a higher than average level of alcohol consumption, and where locally crafted beer, wine, and liquor is celebrated as part of the Vermont economy and a tourism draw. But first, let's mark the 100th anniversary of Prohibition with a look back at how it played out in Vermont. January 17th marks the 100th anniversary. Although the 18th Amendment was actually ratified in 1919, it was the implementation of the Volstead Act in 2020 that gave teeth to the ban on alcohol. The Volstead Act funded the federal agents who could enforce the ban. But Vermont, which had already tried a more local version of Prohibition, also had, as it still does, a fierce independence streak, and of course, a border with Canada. So Vermont's Prohibition history is full of juicy stories and interesting details. And here to share a few is Adam Krakowski, a historian and author of the book Vermont Prohibition, Teetotalers, Bootleggers, and Corruption. He's also written books on brewing history in Burlington and across Vermont. Adam, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back.
Can you talk a little bit about what led up to January 17th, 1920, in terms of the legal process of the 18th Amendment and the Volstead Act?
So the 18th Amendment comes into play. It was something that was brewing in Washington, D.C. for years.
Pun intended,
a lot of course. Yeah, and for a lot of states, they had dabbled in state-induced prohibition, which carried momentum. And finally essentially, the Congress comes together and proposes, because there's not a clear majority of states that had been dry at that point, but enough interest was there that it went into basically heated debates and came out with the 18th Amendment, which went then being a amendment went to the states to ratify. And Vermont, of course, being rather independent, was one of the last to actually ratify it. And to be quite honest, Vermont's vote wasn't needed to ratify that. They'd already achieved the threshold.
So Vermont was one of the last to ratify, but we had already had our own statewide prohibition, at least in official name, for quite a few years earlier. It ended just at the very turn of the century. So why was Vermont late to ratify the constitutional amendment?
So a quick history, just to understand the circumstances, is Vermont's the second state in the country to go dry at a state level in 1853. Maine was the first state in 1851. And Vermont actually stays dry from 1853 all the way through until 1902. And what ends up happening in 1902, which is very important to the 18th Amendment, is Percival Clement chooses to run for the governorship. And while he was a Republican, he wasn't the official Republican candidate, so he decides to run on what's known as the high license local option ticket. And what he basically was proposing at that time was to – his whole stance was to remove prohibition and the state-induced prohibition. And his reasoning was that Vermont was struggling in finances. They were struggling in municipal upkeep, and essentially he looked at something that was a banned substance that was readily available and quite frankly all around still, even though it was illegal, and to make it a town-by-town vote to bring it in with a very high license threshold, tax threshold for alcohol to come off the books. And he ends up not winning the governorship, but comes so close as an independent that the governor that is elected, Governor John McCullough, is forced to make a ruling, if you will, on it. And they decide to take state-induced prohibition officially off the books, except what ends up happening is it does go down to the town level where there are requirements put in place for a minimum amount of voters for a town. And if the town votes yes or no, and also the cost initially to get a license to serve alcohol is extremely high in cost. It was about $2,500 at that time.
Wow. So the reluctance to join on to this idea of federal prohibition, was that because Vermont felt like, look, we did this and it had economic impacts that were not all positive? Or was it this idea that no, this should be a state level decision versus a federal decision? I mean, what was the reluctance then 20 years later?
The reluctance 20 years later was that Percival Clement actually gets elected as governor and spending his whole political career to fight and remove prohibition off the books. He's basically looking at the decision of, do we join the rest of the states that had already done a clear majority to ratify the 18th Amendment, or do we not? And he does sign it in with the state vote, and it is ratified. But again, we were one of the last two states to ratify.
Adam, can you talk a little bit about the temperance movement in Vermont and how that looked here?
Certainly. So the temperance movement in Vermont starts in the 1820s. Vermont, mind you, at the 1820 manufacturing census, actually has over 250 operational distilleries in the state. And we have to start in 1820 looking at alcohol in a different point of view. The way I kind of explain it to folks is picture a time where you have no refrigeration and you have no pasteurization. Microbiology theory is not yet known. So you know that, you know, you can't drink the water because it does make you sick on a lot of occasions, and you have to also store your calories. And in terms of Vermont, we are a pretty rural agricultural state, and a lot of the processing and aging was through malt houses that were malting the local grains, grinding it up for flours, but then also breweries were able to produce beer that is rather shelf-stable because of the alcohol in it. And then distillation was kind of a more concentrated version, but it was mainly for calories. And what happens is we essentially overconsume. There's a lot of accounts in local and regional newspapers about the uprise in drunkenness, violence, public intoxication. But more so, there's a lot of lamenting that there's work on the fields that has yet to be done, people looking for help, and in the help posting, you know, drunkards not apply. And it really starts taking a toll at the social level. And a lot of the temperance movement started in the communities. We're right on the cusp of the what's known as the First Great Awakening. And it's a big religious revival that's kind of sweeping through New England, starting down in southern New England. And the temperance just starts at a local town level, but it starts getting enough signatures and enough momentum over the 1820s, 1830s that it creates a difficult political situation in Montpelier, where Montpelier is getting every year these very long lists of signatures basically asking for Montpelier to do something to regulate alcohol consumption and alcohol production. In most cases, it was just to outlaw it entirely. And by the 1840s, it's enough signatures and enough pressure that in 1848, Vermont actually goes and puts it on the ballot county by county to choose if they go wet or dry. And at that point, most of the counties over the 4 years from 1848 to 1852 start literally juggling between being wet and dry each year, almost as they on a county level that they were experimenting. And ultimately, Erastus Fairbanks was the governor in 1852 and had invited Neal Dow, who was the temperance champion and the mayor of Portland, Maine, to come to the Golden Dome in Montpelier and literally chat with and give a kind of a fire brimstone speech to the legislature. And essentially in literally about 3 week time period, Vermont writes up a law that heavily mimics but not quite copies Maine's law and is very hurriedly signed into law. And literally it's signed in minutes before midnight at the close of the session. So it was literally the last task that the legislature does in 1852. And they give it a window for about a year or so that that time if there's any court challenges or there's public outcry, then all of a sudden, you know, that there's room for them to negotiate in the next legislature to pull that law back, but it goes into effect, and it literally stays into effect 1852 to 1902, and many counties in Vermont were dry all the way through federal repeal. And there was one county this year that officially took prohibition off the books, and I believe that was Barton, Vermont.
So you know that sort of leads us into then the repeal in 1902. And then, of course, the temperance movement was in full steam across the country. And Vermont had had this experience with it. And then this idea of, you know, what are different counties going to do and what's it look like at the county level? So as we enter federal prohibition, you know, did that look the same, look and feel the same in Vermont as the statewide prohibition had, or were there differences in either cultural perceptions of it or enforcement of it?
It completely changes. The author Scott Wheeler had a great quote in his work about prohibition that, you know, in state-induced prohibition, Vermont was always damp, that it wasn't fully dry, it wasn't wet. And once federal prohibition takes into effect, so Vermont at that time at the state level, every international and state boundary around us is wet. So you could easily go a short distance to acquire alcohol and bring it back with you. With the onset of the automobile, and then take into account that now we do still have a boundary that alcohol was permitted, all the attention turned to the northern boundary with Canada. And it was a revenue stream no longer just for Vermont, where the culture really didn't change much at the local level, but it was all the outside influence now of people from New York. It was New York. It was Massachusetts was a main driver in Vermont, as well as Connecticut, using the different roadways and that international boundary to smuggle alcohol over. The other thing that occurs is the development of the line house, which are these buildings that were constructed across the international boundary. And so you literally in some cases have a home that's straddling the international boundary where alcohol's permitted on one side of the house but not the other. And you know, in terms of the line house, that became a draw, an unofficial draw for Vermont. But you also then have constant the stories of the rum runners, heavy police enforcement with these cars carrying loads of alcohol over. The majority of the alcohol was meant for outside of Vermont, the state of Vermont. It was for the cities through New England and New York. But it all of a sudden became a focus and also for many a cash cow.
So did it affect the Vermont economy to be able to have this proximity to the border, even if it was the black market economy?
It did. And it did, though, in a different way, that it wasn't folks themselves bringing alcohol over and selling it. A lot of times they were contracted to do so. And you know, in my book, I kind of shied away from a lot of the oral histories because at the time that I constructed this, there was almost no one left that was the actually primary source of prohibition. A lot of it was the children or secondary or even tertiary stories, which I always kind of have to be wary of because details get lost over time. But what you do find in a lot of the journals that are in the Vermont Historical Society and special collections at UVM and other historical societies around the states are journals and such where you do find folks that farmers, you know, especially up by the boundary, could literally rent out barn space to smugglers just to house a car or load of whiskey and be paid more for, you know, passive, what was known as just passive, you know, accomplice to, you know, rum running and make more than they could make in their fields in a week or even a month. So you did have money start to trickle in to different folks. And to some, they made lots of money. There was an account of one character that I really love in Vermont's federal prohibition period, Lillian Miner. She was known as Queen Lil. And she was she was born in Vermont, had moved to Boston, and was a well-known madame at the Faneuil Follies in Boston, and actually left just before the brothel, if you will, was shut down by police. And she comes back to Vermont, and she tactically in 1911 purchases a property that was a burned out inn on the international boundary. And there's a law in place that you cannot do a new construction across the international boundary, except in her case, there was the original foundation straddling the international boundary, and she hired some very well-known lawyers at the time and was able to successfully argue that she's simply renovating the structure rather than a new construction. And she ends up building one of the most well-known line houses across the Vermont border. And in this line house, she made such revenue. She was always known to be the most stylish woman in the area. And drove a top of the line car, and actually at the time of her passing had a very large property hold of acreage of farmland and properties. So for some, it was it made almost generational wealth, if you will.
So Adam, we're going to spend the rest of the show talking about today and drinking culture and attitudes around alcohol and the ways that they're changing. But I'm curious, before we totally leave the historical perspective, if you see the effects or the legacy of prohibition, both the state and the federal bans, on Vermont's economy and culture today?
I do, very much so. And it's – you have to look back to the 1853 that we essentially cut off our major tax revenue around the state way too early. And what ends up happening is a lot of towns are dwarfed in what they could do in development, in resources. And basically, a reliance goes back to the agricultural landscape, which Vermont's now very well known and very well regarded for. But we basically took ourselves out of the running of being able to really branch out in any massive scale development and manufacturing. And there's cases where throughout the 80 years of state and federal prohibition that there's developers saying how they weren't going to come to Vermont because, they – in one case, they build a resort on the other side of Lake Champlain in New York because – just so that they could serve alcohol to their tourists that come. And we also created just a spider web of laws that have taken many years to untangle, which was the case starting the modern craft industry in Vermont, a craft brewing industry.
We've been looking at prohibition and how it was received and followed or flouted in Vermont. The 100th anniversary of the official start of federal prohibition is January 17th. Adam Krakowski is going to stay with us as we jump from 1920 to 2020. For the rest of the show, we're going to look at alcohol and culture today. We're going to tackle dry January, movement away from drinking culture, and why Vermont continues to be a state with higher than average alcohol consumption. At some local bars, bartenders are thinking up ways to cater to people who want sophisticated drinks but don't want them to come with alcohol. Emily Morton is the general manager and bartender at Deli 126, a Prohibition-era-themed speakeasy in Burlington. The bar has all the trappings of the age with Art Deco decor and a jazzy atmosphere, and Morton offers an array of alcohol-free temperance cocktails that pay homage to the teetotaler ethos, like this one.
We're making this one's verjus. So first ingredient is our homemade cinnamon syrup, which is like a demerara base, just a bar spoon of that. A half ounce of sand bitter, which is this bitter Italian soda. So a half ounce of that. A full ounce of this white verjus. And then an ounce and a half of iced dandelion root tea, which is giving flavor and volume. A little ice in the stirring glass. And a couple stirs. So our cocktail glass here, pour it in. So this ends up being like a really lovely, kind of light between a brown and a red, kind of like a burnt sienna crayon from the Crayola back. We're garnishing with an orange twist. So we're going to wipe the edge with some of that orange peel and then just stick it right in there. And then this one's verjus.
Verjus, by the way, is an acidic, non-alcoholic juice made from pressing unripened grapes or sometimes other tart fruits. I had to look it up. We've been looking at prohibition and how it played out in Vermont 100 years ago. But what about today? How are ideas and norms around drinking evolving and changing? Many people take the time in January to rethink their relationship with alcohol, as things like Dry January have become popular. And in Vermont, health officials worry about higher than average rates of drinking, even as the tourism and economic officials celebrate Vermont's craft beverage industry. It's a complicated relationship we have to alcohol, so let's talk about it. And let's start back at Deli 126, the Prohibition-era-themed speakeasy in Burlington. There, bartender and general manager Emily Morton created a menu of temperance cocktails, a nod to the theme of the bar, but also to changes in the way people want to experience social drinking.
Our temperance cocktail menu is all non-alcoholic, and we choose to call them temperance cocktails, not non-alcoholic or mocktails or anything like that, since we are trying to take a 1920s prohibition vibe, kind of bringing in the temperance movement to that, which obviously started prohibition. It's funny that we have this like cyclical, it's happening, like it's 100 years, it's happening. And now we're kind of doing temperance cocktails and non-alcoholic drinks have sort of become popular again 100 years later.
Of course, the temperance movement of the early 20th century was directed toward regulating and restricting drinking for everyone. And today's temperance movement, if you could call it that, seems more geared around self-improvement and individual choices, which makes the commingling of alcoholic and non-alcoholic drinks and drinkers at the same speakeasy both possible and joyful, according to Morton.
Friends and family members who are sober, who are pregnant, other people in the industry or just in general that want to take time off from drinking still feel like they can come here after their shift with all of their other colleagues who are going to get, you know, beers and cocktails or whatever. They can still get something and enjoy themselves. It just kind of helps us be this like community where everyone is welcome and everyone is accepted. That even if someone has had a struggle in their life, they don't have to feel bad about coming into a bar environment. They can still be here and feel like there's something here for them.
Over the last decade, the idea of creating sophisticated drinks without alcohol, think more like that Verjus mocktail than the Shirley Temple, have been gaining speed. But many people have an uneasy relationship to alcohol, to say the least. Historian and author Adam Krakowski is still with us. He's written books on brewing history in Burlington and around Vermont, and he follows the latest trends in craft beverages across the state in his writing with Yankee Brew News. Also joining us now is Dr. Jan Carney, a professor and associate dean for public health and health policy at UVM's Larner College of Medicine. Dr. Carney is also former state health commissioner from 1989 through 2003. Dr. Carney, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Are you reflecting on the 100th anniversary of Prohibition?
I am now.
Good. Yes, you better be. How do you connect it to today? We heard Adam talking about some of the economic connections and the way Vermont's agricultural economy in some ways is tied to prohibition. How do you see it, and how do you see the connections maybe more socially?
What strikes me is the important influence of culture and how we think about alcohol and our use of alcohol. And I think that the culture and our times were different 100 years ago, but we have analogous pressures and economic pressures and personal health concerns and illness and all kinds of factors that it relates very strongly to our culture of today.
Let's go to Wayne, who's calling in with us from Hinesburg. Hi, Wayne.
Hey, hello.
Hi, we'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so I think I read the book about alcohol or prohibition in Vermont, and it was really interesting. And personally, I quit drinking about 7 years ago. I kind of recognized a pattern that was heading in the wrong direction and decided to just stop. And what I found a little challenging with that is for me, and of course it's different for everybody, but so much of my social life was tied to consuming alcohol that it's kind of been an adjustment that's taken me kind of a long time. It's almost like when you go out sometimes there's this expectation that you're going to have a drink. Now, nobody's asking me, nobody's forcing me, but there's almost, I have this own feeling about it, which is kind of interesting to know. And so I like that some of these businesses are coming up with these kind of more craft, I guess, mocktails, for lack of a better term, that can kind of make you feel part of that social aspect of it whilst not having alcohol.
So Wayne, that would work for you. You don't have an issue with going into a bar environment and having a drink. It's just that you would like it not to have alcohol.
Right. And then, you know, the choices now are like, you know, high sugar soda or Diet Coke or something like that for the most part.
Well, Wayne, thanks for calling in and sharing your perspective and your decision to stop drinking and how you saw it affecting your life. We got a note from Robin who says, I spent many years drinking heavily and I've been sober for 4 years as of New Year's Day. Congratulations, Robin. She writes, it was very difficult to navigate an alcohol-free lifestyle at first. My social life obviously had to change without drinking, and that wasn't surprising. But what became clear is that things are set up to normalize drinking at all times. Yin and tonic yoga classes, knit, paint, craft, and sips. And now even Montpelier's Winter Farmers Market is at a distillery. Sometimes when I've criticized how much drinking permeates everyday life, I've been told that people drink and I should get over it. Or that I am, quote, welcome to show up and just not drink. Many of us find it crazy that we have to actively work to stay sober through everyday life. There is a sobriety movement that is getting louder and bigger. If you're looking for it, you can find a very rich sober community on social media. People are starting to offer yoga studios, clothing lines, and fitness clubs devoted to recovery. This is essential for folks who don't relate to the traditional AA model but still need a place to go. Alcoholics don't even necessarily use the alcoholic label. We are your coworkers, moms, church friends, and service workers. Some folks never even experienced problematic drinking. They just never liked it to begin with. Wouldn't it be great if drinkers were the weirdos and folks who didn't find alcohol entertaining were the normies? Adam, how do you see this shift? And, you know, I don't want to overemphasize it because certainly what we see from Vermont's drinking rates and national drinking rates is that alcohol consumption is very high. But on social media and through pop culture, you see this trend toward Dry January and you see a trend toward people who say, I don't consider myself an alcoholic, but I would like to lead a sober lifestyle. So, Adam, how do you see this shift?
I think, number one, it's a great growth right now in the last few years of many different options for many different folks. And the just like the Deli 126 with the temperance cocktail list, you also see other places really expanding and putting care into a different beverages, unique beverages that cater to everybody. And it's something that has been gaining steam, and I'm truly for it because just as the caller Wayne had said about going into a social atmosphere, you know, unfortunately, a lot of Vermont's social hubs outside of the cities are in a local tavern, restaurant, downtown, or cafe. And having options for everybody means that everybody's welcome. And it's something that also Vermont craft beverage producers have seen and really putting some care into.
I want to play another clip from Emily Morton, the bartender that we visited at Deli 126, who was talking about her temperance menu and talking specifically about how she crafts these drinks and what they should taste and feel and seem like. So here's how she says this.
A good friend of mine who's sober, he said when you don't drink anymore, you don't want products that are emulating what your drug was. So having like non-alcoholic gin and tonic or a non-alcoholic other kind of cocktail, it's like not really ideal because you're trying to get away from that and you're trying to get away from having those drinks that kind of triggered your addiction. So I've tried to be really conscious of not trying to emulate necessarily cocktails like that, to not like, oh, this is a non-alcoholic gin and tonic, or like, oh, this is a non-alcoholic whatever.
Now, that's not going to work for everybody. Some people don't want to be in a bar environment at all. But Dr. Kearney, do you think that this is a positive approach or a positive change to have these places where people who drink alcohol and people who don't want to drink alcohol, whether it's that night or ever, have a place to connect together in this sort of social environment and in this way that we do socialize so frequently as Americans in bars and restaurants?
I think having that option is a positive thing. And if we think about and the point that our default is really social drinking, and what if we flip that around and said not drinking was the default? And so if we think about people are conscious of a healthier lifestyle, what we eat, whether or not we're physically active, not using alcohol, and being conscious about that can be a very positive thing from a health perspective. And if people are wondering about, you know, what does that mean? You know, what level of alcohol? You mentioned that Vermont has as a serious alcohol problem as a population, as a state. And that's that's a long-term trend. We're not alone. Northern tier states, if you look across the country, have that problem. But there's a lot of health risks involved related to that. Maybe a little bit about definitions or health problems?
Yeah, I would love that. I'd love to know what our actual average rate is and how that compares, but then also what health officials, and then maybe we can all talk about what we socially think of as excessive drinking or problematic drinking.
Right. Okay. The Vermont does, and this information is from national surveys, and through the Department of Health organizes that and publishes this regularly. And past month, alcohol use for people 12 and older in Vermont were among the highest in the country in all age groups.
And when you say past month, you mean the survey asks, have you used alcohol in the past month?
In we're not talking about as a general use of alcohol. That's right. That's one of the questions. And it's about 2/3 of people in Vermont on average say they have, adults, or actually 12 and older. And then binge drinking. And what is binge drinking? And that's defined as 4 more drinks at a time, at a single sitting, for women, and 5 or more for men. And binge drinking among people age 12 and over in Vermont is also very high, about more than 25%. Some of the other, what's moderate drinking, you know, and how do we, and why do we have these definitions? In part, it's so we can see what the health impact is. And nationally, there's about 88,000 deaths related to, premature deaths related to alcohol, putting it behind nutrition and physical activity and tobacco use in our country. So very serious problem. What is moderate alcohol consumption? And our dietary guidelines for Americans, the most current ones say that it is up to 1 drink per day for women and up to 2 drinks per day for men. And how do they determine these? Well, levels over that are associated with some kind of health effect. And we can think about short-term health effects related to binge drinking. That might be a motor vehicle accident, unintended sex and risk for sexually transmitted infections or HIV, things like injuries, personal injuries, and longer-term effects, adverse consequences related to diseases of the heart or stroke, blood pressure, liver, on. So alcohol misuse, and there's a lot of confusion around terminology. So a couple simple ways is total how much alcohol people drink, and then how much they drink at a time, and that's the binge drinking. And alcohol misuse, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention talks about that. Some people call that risky drinking, and they say generally for women, it's more than 1 drink per day on the average, so 8 or more drinks, and for men, more than 2 drinks per day on the average. And then the binge drinking for women, 4 or more drinks on a single occasion, men, 5. And if you think about sort of overall and then at a single sitting, those kind of define the boundaries of risky behavior. And then if you look at across the population, about 70% of people fall into this kind of moderate drinking or no drinking category. About 25% fall into this risky drinking category, and then 5% or so fall into the category of what's called alcohol use disorder, which is the terminology for people with more serious dependence on alcohol and risk for health issues from alcohol.
Can I ask you, Dr. Carney, just as a side note, the differences in the 1 drink for women per day is considered, you know, a moderate approach, and 2 for men. Is that based on weight differences, or are there differences in biological sex that would lead health officials to say more than 1 drink for women is not advised, even if the weight differences are sort of leveled out?
Weight and metabolism that are different.
We're talking about our relationship to alcohol today and different trends in drinking, both in terms of alcohol consumption, but also trends around not drinking and trends around different kinds of drinks that might be interesting but not have alcohol. Let's go to Kim, who's calling in from Norton. Hi, Kim. Nice to talk with you.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a retired drug and alcohol professional and sober myself for 30 years. And, you know, I've been in this work, my own social life. And what I typically find is it's that you have establishments that do, you know, cater to people who don't want to have drinks with alcohol in them. But the socialization in those venues is typically not that great, for the simple reason that people who are drinking and people who are not drinking hit a wall. There's I think there's a level of impairment socially even with people who are more moderate in their use, that is very apparent to people who aren't drinking. So when somebody gets that, even two or three drinks in the course of an evening, they're just not quite as nimble in many ways.
So for you, Kim, do you see a need for, as Dr. Carney was talking about, a different kind of socialization or ways that we think about our social lives, not one that necessarily has bars or restaurants where people – some people are drinking and some aren't. You see a need for a different kind of social life as well?
I don't know if it's a need, but I think it's something that would really be well – it'd be very well accepted. What drew me to call was this whole idea of what's normal and what's not. So if you go into an establishment that, you know, it's normal to be drinking, it's not that much fun for people who aren't drinking. And it's not for any other reason other than that levels of intimacy and, you know, whether it's emotional intimacy or more intellectual intimacy, or even, you know, if you're there to get your physical intimacy needs met. Mm. It's just not the same for people who aren't drinking. So if the establishment is, say, 85% people who are drinking and 15% people who are not, it's not that much fun. But if you're in an environment where 85% of people aren't drinking, I think it's – I don't know how you do that, but I think it would be something that would really be catching on.
Yeah, Kim, thanks for your comments and your thoughts. And that question of what's normal is a key one here as we think about our culture and our relationship to alcohol and that sort of quote-unquote normal and normalized behavior. Adam writes in to say, my wife and I have done dry January the last 3 years as a way to take a break after the overindulgent holidays. It's a great way to take a break, return to a cleaner diet, and then appreciate alcohol more when we do return to drinking. Alex in Burlington says, I rarely drink. It's a habit that grew out of supporting my sober friends. I'll have a drink about once or twice a month, but like preparing vegetarian food at gatherings to include my vegetarian friends, I don't tend to socialize with alcohol so as to include my sober friends. We got a note from Honey Road chef Kara Chigazola-Tobin, who writes, as a chef and someone in the restaurant industry, I've noticed a shift within the industry itself. A lot of chefs and restaurant workers are going sober or are sober curious. And because of this, I think you're seeing more non-alcoholic drinks, which is helping to support the no or low alcohol movement. Adam, I'd love your thoughts on that, because, you know, the restaurant industry and the food and beverage industry is one where there is a lot of drinking. And even at some restaurants, and Kara, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, restaurants like yours that will say you can buy a bucket of beers for the chefs and the workers in the restaurant. And do you see, Adam, this shift happening even within the food and beverage industry?
Very much so. And what I also appreciate is that a lot of chefs have been very forthcoming in their own experiences, but also more importantly, through interviews both on radio, podcasts, and printed long-form pieces, they've also discussed what they've instituted at their own restaurants, which allows folks to basically have a roadmap for their own kitchens. And two very good examples, I think, is the crew at Joe Beef that this year had a long form piece in the New Yorker, just outlining why they've a restaurant that's known, a world class restaurant that's known for their food and alcohol, that the owners and chefs are no longer, they're basically no longer in, the mindset of alcohol, and how that affected their food, how it affected their workplace. And recently I heard a great interview with Angie Marr, who's the owner of the Beatrix Inn in New York City. And when she purchased the restaurant, one of the first things that she did was completely eliminate the what was known as the shift drink, which was a beer or a drink after your shift was done in the kitchen. And she, in this interview, she actually had said about how much pushback she got, that she opted to say, this is the rule and you don't like it, leave. And she actually had a lot of staff leave over it. But her finding, though, was that she actually got a better crew that she gelled with, that she worked with well, and has been able to really build upon it. And it is carrying into the industry. And you know, again, it's something that I think is very positive because it allows people to find their comfort zone. And if their comfort zone in the restaurants and kitchens is, you know, to their ideal spot, you know, you see the creativity in the food coming out of the kitchens and the attention getting drawn to the restaurants.
Yeah. And we'll post our conversation with the two guys behind Joe Beef where they talked about that and sobriety on today's show page. Senator Allison Clarkson is calling in from Woodstock. And Senator Clarkson, I want to get you in, but we're short on time. So I'm going to ask you to truncate your thoughts, but I want to hear them.
Oh, happy to. I just wanted to address the cost to the state. I don't think people focus on the hard and social costs that the state incurs as a result of the abuse of alcohol. There are huge financial costs and huge social costs. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars dealing with the effect of alcohol in domestic violence, in our courts, in corrections, in Medicaid. And that's, you know, some of those have been addressed by the people you've had on who've been terrific. But I just wanted to make sure that listeners understood the huge costs that their tax dollars are helping pay for.
Senator Clarkson, thank you for bringing that up. And it's interesting, you know, we're not going to have time to do the comparison here, but as we look at economic benefits of craft brewing and distilleries and tourism versus the economic costs of alcohol, it'd be interesting to weigh those out. Dr. Carney, I'm going to give you the last word, and I'd love to know as you think about this, how we should be thinking, how you think as a health professional that we should be thinking about alcohol and whether there's even a quote-unquote healthy relationship that we can have to alcohol.
I think that we have a mixed relationship with alcohol, and I was glad to hear the emphasis on the kind of the negative aspects, because I do think we have to keep this right in the forefront and do everything we can to prevent that harm and make treatment available to people. We haven't talked about young people, but it's really important to create a culture in which they can abstain from all alcohol until they do become young adults if they choose to drink at all, and we avoid all those costs which are severe. I'm delighted to hear about this potential for a social movement around not drinking and making and not having alcohol and alcohol use and every social occasion being the norm and having not drinking being the norm. I think there's potential for health benefits from that.
Well, it's an interesting ongoing conversation, and I appreciate both of you having it with us today. Dr. Jan Carney is a professor and associate dean for public health and health policy at UVM's Lerner College of Medicine and former health commissioner for the state. Thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Adam Krakowski is a historian and author of the book Vermont Prohibition, Teetotalers, Bootleggers, and Corruption, among other books, and he writes for Yankee Brew News as well. Adam, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks again.